In this Money Maze podcast curated discussion, we're going to interview a manager with a very specific focus. I'm here with Daniel Avigard of Lansdowne Partners, who manages their $1.3 billion European fund. Daniel originally worked for 5 years in the number one Extel-ranked pan-European telecoms team at Dresdner Climeworks and has been at Lansdowne Partners since April 2006. And he sits on the management committee. He's refreshingly modest about his investment results, managing the European long-only fund, but quietly passionate, if that's not a contradiction, about the opportunities his concentrated fund is invested in. So, Daniel, welcome to this edition of the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Simon.
Daniel, you don't conform to many of the money managers we encounter on our travels. You hold a master's degree with distinction in information technology and a first-class honours for your bachelor degree in mechanical engineering with mathematics. And more usually, you are a CFA. But tell me, first of all, how do those 2 degrees help you analysing companies?
Very interesting question to start off with. Well, I like to think that we are very quantitative about the way in which we look at the world. I think that in reality, it's very hard to think about economics the same way you can about the real world, such as physics and mathematics. But there are some parts of the skill set that can be brought across with respect to rigorous analysis and trying to wipe away the subjectivity of some of the assumptions that we see so many others building into their work. So I think it's about a rigor and a framework and a structure that one can take from the world of science and mathematics to impose on economics. But of course, recognizing that there is a behavioral aspect that can't easily be synthesized in the physical world.
So I want to just have a quick recap of the fund before we dive down into process and ideas and themes. You've been managing the fund since?
Yeah, since 2012, so 10 years now.
Since 2012. You have $1.3 billion in assets. And in terms of its market cap, how would you describe the fund?
Market cap of the typical stock is about $20 billion. So it's sort of large mid-cap, let's say, all public European equities, continental Scandinavia, UK and Switzerland.
And your performance has been strong. Just talk me through, you know, the outperformance.
So our objective is to outperform public European equity benchmarked, say, the MSCI Europe Total Return Index by 300 basis points annualized through a cycle. We're currently achieving that. Our one-year outperformance is about 5% net. A three-year annualized outperformance is just over 6%. And on a five-year basis, that's running at about 4% annualized. So achieving our targets, and we think from the benchmark analysis we have versus our competitors, we're somewhere in the top decile on a 1, 3, and 5 year view against the 500 peer universe that we are compared to.
Great. Now, currently the fund is in a Cayman format, am I right in saying, but your thinking is you're going to have a UCITS within a matter of months?
Yes, that indeed is our ambition. So within the next 6 to 8 weeks, we will be launching for the first time a UCITS variant of our existing fund.
So if I was summing up before we get into this philosophy, it's a concentrated long-term fund investing in European equities based on deep diligence, fundamental analysis, and active engagement.
Absolutely right.
So you describe your team's approach as more bottom-up than top-down. And I want to get into the weeds of this researching, because let's start with your approach. Research means lots of things to different organizations. I know you're not a big user of the sell side. Just tell me how you and Lansdowne have built up your library of knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. So I have been analyzing European equity markets for over 2 decades, with the first 5 years at Lansdowne being both on the long only, but also long short side, which obviously is creating a set of experiences that I find useful today, despite only doing long only now. For the last 2 decades, we have followed a very active engagement with companies through the creation of what I call proprietary investment presentations that are effectively the distillation of our investment hypothesis into a set of charts. So think about a deck of 50 charts, which distill really what we think are the levers that could be used by management to create value. And we go to meet with the senior management of the company and their stakeholders around the company to try to understand if they are thinking about things in that way or something we're missing, or indeed on a smaller number of occasions, actions that we think they could deploy to create shareholder value for the benefit of everybody. So by now we have a library, let's call it a library of IP, of presentations that we've created for over 300 unique companies in Europe. At least once we will have produced that presentation for them and for some companies that we've owned for many years, many, many times. That in reality is creating the opportunity to build a level of partnership with the management teams of companies across the European universe, which we think allows us to have an open dialogue with them in a way that is only possible because they start to trust that we are long-term investors in their shares. And it additionally opens up access to lower levels of management where you really get to understand how the businesses really work because, you know, they're willing to talk to us on that sort of depth as a result of those sorts of relationships that we've built. So we feel like after 2 decades of doing that, we're in the harvesting phase because after a number of different management teams across the company, you start to have some sort of feel for where that business is going.
I'd written here that it was quite an unconventional approach and you can become, I guess, sort of more of an ally, particularly since you're not shorting and you're long only. How do you prepare for those meetings with management?
I think the critical point is to have within one's mindset a degree of independence. So we're not advocates of the company to the company, nor are we trying to short them. It's a very independent perspective, which in effect they're not paying for. And as a result, it's authentic. It's different to a consultant. And I think, you know, the preparation, therefore, is really to try to make sure that when we are going to invest in a company, we've done as thorough due diligence as we possibly can. And I think to a certain extent, as you recognized early on, the dependence on the sell side to produce information is very limited because of the, dare I say it, reduction in quality of the output of the sell side over the last 2 decades because of the regulatory consequences on the profit of those business models. But also, I think we increasingly very much value primary evidence. So proprietary analysis based on primary evidence, which means that we want to source the information ourselves in a post-truth world. That is probably the right thing to be thinking about doing. So we use lots of different ways to understand the terms of trade of a company and how it's changing. So we will think very hard about interactions with former labor, former managers, the competitors, the regulator, the anchor shareholders, the governments, the unions, the third party expert magazines for the industry and the trade, and try to synthesize competition commission investigations should they happen, use zip code analysis with geospatial data, just everything and anything that we can do to establish the terms of trade of that industry and how it may evolve.
Right. Well, that's very clear. So as we step down this investment process, let's talk about capital cycles and why they're central to your approach.
Yes, exactly. I think we've just talked a little bit about the engagement methodology. So perhaps on the investment philosophy itself, as you say, Simon, we think that all companies are operating within, as our industries are operating within capital cycles. And in a way, we think the capital cycle for an industry can be compared to the human life cycle. So if you think about it in multi-decade stages, there's actually 3 stages simplistically. The first is infancy, the second is adolescence, and the third is maturity. You know, and dare I say it, as with humans, a very exciting phase in one's life, both as a company, as a human, is infancy because you're growing and growth is, you know, very attractive in terms of generating supernormal returns if there isn't enough supply for the product. And if that demand is either undiscounted in magnitude or duration, that's an opportunity for alpha. So the first opportunity set we see in Europe is a structural demand side opportunity, thinking about that early stage in the capital cycle. The second major opportunity set in Europe, again, is a structural one. It's not cyclical. It's a structural supply side opportunity. And there I'm talking about the transition within a company's capital cycle from the adolescent stage to the mature stage. And the adolescent stage is characterized by oversupply, an industry with too much capacity, poor pricing power, terrible returns on capital. Typically, share prices are very weak. Eventually, the pain is so great that it forces capital to leave that industry or consolidate into fewer hands. And that company or industry makes the transition from adolescence to maturity. It's not ever going to be as attractive as during that first infancy growth bonanza. But now at least they can earn reasonable returns on capital. And typically at that point of transition, everyone's very negative and valuations are very depressed. So two major opportunity sets within that capital cycle, both structural, not cyclical, one related to growth and one related to a supply or to withdrawal of supply.
Right. Now that leads us very nicely into three of the themes that I know you have written about and spoken about, which are digitization, decarbonization, and electrification. And I wonder why you think these are game changers.
Well, the first point I'd make is just with respect to thinking about the capital cycle, the things that we look for as catalysts to assess when an industry or company may shift in its position within its capital cycle, we see four catalysts. The first is changes in regulation. The second is changes as a consequence of technological disruption. The third, related to the cost of capital, so interest rates. And the fourth, related to changes in consumer preference, so utility of demand. And the reason I state this up front is because when you ask the question, why are these game changers? Because each of those is at least hitting one of, or if not more, of those catalysts. The principal point related to decarbonisation is both a change in regulation and consumer habits is driving a fundamental shift in how companies approach decarbonisation. It's very clear, for example, that when externalities start to be priced, like carbon, in the history of most businesses, they were free, that's going to create a major shock in their terms of trade. If you think about the regulatory outcome, it's very, very nascent at this point, but it's still very, very early. And we have built, for example, 20 interacting bottom-up industry models to try to assess the price at which carbon must rise to create the incentive for each of those hard-to-abate sectors to switch to zero-carbon alternative forms of production. By doing so, we think we've built a global carbon cost curve. And the implication of that is to have any chance of achieving net zero, the carbon price has to double. We started saying that when it had to quadruple, and it's halfway there. And if one thinks through the implications of that, not least for the solution providers, their addressable market expands the higher the carbon price, but also the losers who will have to pay the penalties for that higher carbon cost. We see a large amount of bifurcation in the industries across Europe, creating the opportunity for alpha, both inclusion into your fund of the winners and very much exclusion of those which will likely be the victims. And I think the next decade, if the last decade was about beta for asset allocators in meeting returns obligations, the next decade, I think, is very much going to require alpha. And this is the type of framework, we think, which lends itself to thinking about these structural shifts in the world's economy and politics, and therefore leaves us, we think, well positioned for that type of change in environment.
So we're going to talk a little bit later about why your fund looks different from a lot of other European funds. But I want to stay with these important themes. And maybe we could just look at this French electrification as an illustration of why you're excited.
Yeah, so we just talked about decarbonisation as one of the game changers. And I think our analysis, we've really tried to think holistically about this, concludes that to achieve net zero, we really need sort of three things to happen. The first thing that has to happen is a doubling in the carbon price very quickly. The second thing that needs to happen is primary energy consumption, which today, electricity contributes 15% of primary energy consumption. We think it has to go to 65% globally. The third is we've got to start reforesting land. I think that second piece, that electrification, really is going to be major. It's a cornerstone of decarbonisation taking place globally. Now, actually, Europe's very well positioned in terms of incubating, because of the draconian regulatory environment, a lot of the global solution providers to decarbonise, to solve the climate crisis. And the electrification industry vertical is going to be absolutely critical. Now, in the last two decades, I think growth, investors think of growth as synonymous only with Silicon Valley in the US. And, you know, undoubtedly that's the case. The global leadership in software engineering really is in Silicon Valley. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other areas geographically where growth can emerge. And often because we're so used to looking one way, we don't see it coming somewhere else. My view is actually that Europe houses two potential global growth engines for the future, the first of which is the French electrification industry vertical. So to electrify is critical to meet net zero. Net zero is critical to the world, and therefore France is going to play a key part. Why? Because I think actually it started very early down this path, perhaps because of the defense requirements and the thought process around nuclear. But if you look through the entire electrification industry vertical in France, it has global leaders in many different areas. For example, the electrical equipment OEs like Schneider and Legrand. You know, if you think about the electrical distributors, Rexel, Sonepar, think about the construction, it's Vinci, and so on and so forth. So software engineering leadership, Silicon Valley. Electrification industry or electrical engineering, France. Mechanical engineering, Scandinavia. And I think some of the long-term family capital in Sweden, for example, the nexus that is built there between cross-shareholdings and cross-board representation between some of the likes of Industrivärden, the Wallenberg whole network, and you know, you go through the likes of Epiroc, Boliden, Volvo, ABB, and all those companies, global mechanical engineering leadership is also in Europe. Thinking about those two niches in Europe is as real pools of long-term alpha is one of the things that we're focused very much on.
And why do you think the market has been less interested in those two areas?
I think the first point is that the value of electrification is only just beginning. The last two decades, global electricity consumption was flat. To have a chance of achieving net zero, global electricity consumption has to be 5 to 6% per annum. So this is an industry that the market has perceived in a not very exciting phase past its infancy in that capital cycle analogy I just gave you. So what we're saying is there's actually a fairly grown up industry that's actually getting a massive demand, positive demand shock, going back into the infancy stage of its life cycle because the growth in demand is now about to pick up massively because of that regulatory tailwind. And the market doesn't price it as such. It sees it as a sleepy industry, which actually we think really isn't.
And tell me a little bit about the risk-reward trade-offs, because I think you've written that your emphasis preferred to be on the low-cost solutions at the low end of the carbon cost curve.
Yeah, that's right, Simon. We started doing webinars about 3 years ago. And in one of the first webinars that we did, we talked about the lack of a stable equilibrium between all of the stakeholders that are required in order for the climate crisis to be resolved in a sensible, timely way. So by that, what I am saying is it's really nice to want it, but to actually create a system that can generate net zero is very, very complex. And I think the trade-offs are between, you know, the rich and the poor, the West and the East, within Europe, between the nations and the EU, between hard-to-abate sectors and easy-to-abate ones, between solution providers and heavy emitters, the rich and the poor. I mean, there's just so many different equilibriums between stakeholders that are going to have to simultaneously be reached. And I think, in a sense, this sort of regulatory approach that we've seen to date, while well-intentioned, has created some unintended side effects. We can see one manifestation of that happening as we speak, which is over-reliance on a third country to supply energy to Europe when we don't politically have any alignment with them at this point. And so the regulatory approach, I feel, has been one-dimensional and linear. And actually, we're talking about a complex system which is multivariate and non-linear. And I feel that when we start to really look at the consequences of trying to achieve net zero, some of the very highly subsidized high-cost solutions are ultimately going to prove unaffordable or incompatible with peace. And that means that we are going to rely ever more on the lowest cost, easiest solutions. Therefore, the low end of the carbon cost curve, energy efficiency, automation, digitalization, rather than the high end, let's say, with new technologies and meme stocks, is where one wants to be focused. That's where the optionality has the greatest value. But a lot of them haven't really been focused on so much because, as I say, it's the indirect beneficiaries, not the meme stocks that, you know, you really want to own.
Right. So I understand the electrification. I'm not sure I completely understand the digitization because it's upon us all, but you have marked it out as an area where you are identifying particular opportunity.
there's many reasons to think digitalization is core to future prosperity. I'll highlight two. The second one is going to be related to the environment. The first is that I think in a world in which we're going into, which is deglobalizing, it is going to become very hard to rely on a pool of labor for a company that says it has high standards of good governance. Because if you rely on a pool of labor whose price and volume is volatile, it is hard to say that you are implementing high standards of good governance. It's actually an ESG question. You need to automate. The second point is, if you want to decarbonize, there's a lot of R&D that needs to be funded. Huge amounts, trillions, because many industries don't have the solution. So there's a very big R&D budget to spend on. And the issue is that in an environment where we are spending money today to solve a terminal value question for the world, in the near term, it's just adding debt to the economy without utility. Let me explain. In the automotive sector, we are substituting combustion engines for electric motors. That doesn't change the fact that you move from point A to point B. It just costs more in the near term because we have to find the way to do that technologically. That's great because it saves the planet in the long run, but it's more debt in the near term without additional productivity. So the economy is not growing during this environment, but we're having to spend a lot more. How do you spend a lot more when the economy is not growing? You have to find a way to cut costs to redirect those savings into the environmental R&D. And the best way to cut costs as a company is to digitalize and automate. So I'm arguing that the economy has to digitalize and automate in order to free up resources to invest in the R&D that's going to save the environment. And the two are inextricably linked, though they don't appear to be so directly.
And one or two illustrations of that at a company level would be what?
Yeah, a really good example for me at least is Capgemini, which as you know is the IT services provider. It employs about 300,000 people, many of which are IT specialists. And I think it's done a very interesting acquisition of a company called Altran, which is the global leader in outsourced R&D services. And I think that's a fascinating acquisition because what we're doing in Europe is finding ways to fund expensive R&D to decarbonize the environment. And to do so efficiently, you have to use your R&D budget efficiently. And being an outsourced R&D partner is the best way to do that. Then the question is, how can you even afford to spend on outsourced R&D, let alone your own R&D? And the answer to that is you've got to take out costs so that you can free up resources. The best way to take out costs is to substitute labor for capital. What I mean by that is investment in IT to automate and digitalize your processes. So what I think is so interesting about what Capgemini has done is it's recognized that European corporates across most industries have to find a way to automate and digitalize so that they can invest in meeting R&D requirements to achieve decarbonization. And that's actually fascinating because not even the largest player in their industry, Accenture, has recognized this. I think that's a relation to the fact that, you know, Capgemini is mainly a European-focused industry and Europe is a value-added economy. It's all about industrial exports. And it, to be honest, always has been. And I think that in turn is by dint of its natural resources being relatively slim, its land availability being relatively low, and the need to really generate value through co-opting labor to build businesses and to produce goods. Very different to other parts of the world, which are abundant with natural resources, where, frankly, the model to be rich is to dominate those resources rather than to co-opt others into building corporates. So that Capgemini example, I think, is a microcosm of the situation that many European corporates are facing. And as a supplier of the scarce skills that are required to enable that transition for their customer landscape, they're very well positioned in our mind.
So when I look at your fund and listen to your approach, I'm struck that it's very clear, but then I look at the data and you appear to have little or low historic correlation with popular macro factors or other styles. Is that a deliberate function of your approach, do you think?
Yes. So I've learned over time, the way we think about this is that we want to maximize the quotient of our finite risk budget on the investments we're making at a company specific level. So, you know, we have 25 positions that we want to, you know, work day and night to understand, and then we want to deploy the capital at risk against those investment views. And by maximizing that type of risk, we also simultaneously want to minimize the unintended factorial exposures that just adding up positions together could potentially create at a portfolio level. So in a sense, what we're trying to do is allow us to spend all of our time concentrating on understanding businesses better and much less of our time trying to anticipate what factorial shift is next coming in the market, which, you know, is something that is a separate skill set altogether. And so what we have done is created a lot of sort of portfolio level risk controls to continuously monitor and measure the exposure that the portfolio is expressing at an aggregate level. So 7 evening daily emails, a weekly risk meeting with a 60-page risk deck that gets updated every week, a valuable third-party input from an independent Lansdowne risk team, all of which to try and triangulate our aggregate risk exposure at the portfolio level so that we're not unintentionally doing things that we don't understand, which I think is really the source of bad trading that many can fall into when you get a major factor rotation. You don't want to be making any decisions or bad decisions. And the best way to avoid that is having thought about measuring it in anticipation of the fact that it will happen.
So I think we've all noted in UK and Europe the growth of PE activity and targeting of companies. And I wonder, and I know that you have an ex-Bain Capital colleague on your team, we'll talk about your team in a minute. Do you think you're employing a similar lens to the PE world in some of these situations you're looking at?
Yes, that's right. I do think that you could say that some of our approach is PE and public markets. I mean, there's obviously a very big difference in types of PE as there are inside all industries. That my view is sort of we're proactive or active, but not really activist.
And how have you organized your team, and you know, how does your team work within the Lansdowne structure?
Both the firm and the team structure is incredibly important if you want to be a high performance entity for any length of time. My deep beliefs is that a small team offers a greater probability of success than a large team, simply because the fewer the relationships, the closer we can work together and build something and have enough alignment between each other. That's the second point. I have a roadmap within my team such that everyone who works here can become a fund partner, so that no one is paid as labor and everyone can be paid as capital with shared incentives. We try to build non-monetary incentives that create alignment within our team as well. We do a mentorship program, we do an intern program, we do a charity program where we collectively choose who to donate to on an annual basis as a share of the profits of the fund. We take very seriously the idea that the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. And we've actually gone as far as doing a psychometric test to understand what it is specifically that each individual is biased towards, and also what potential implications at an aggregate fund level that can have. And it's well worth it. I would highly recommend it. It was one of the sort of seriously beneficial experiences that I've had in my life, personally speaking.
Gosh, well, that is a first in the interviews that we have conducted. Is there anything that you won't buy? And if so, why?
I won't buy things I don't understand. If we go back to our investment framework, I talked about the capital cycle and shifts in it being really critical in terms of our understanding. And I mentioned four catalysts. One of those catalysts was consumer habits changing. Now, consumer habits can change in predictable ways, i.e. related to demographics, for example. You can relatively straightforwardly expect over very long periods of time that a big cohort will behave in this way if they're getting older or younger or whatever, richer, poorer. The things that I find very hard in consumer habits is where you have shifts in mass psychology that are very unpredictable. So, for example, whether a handbag is going to be more popular than a watch in the next 3 years or vice versa, or whether a brand within a handbag or watch industry is going to become more popular. Very hard to anticipate fads and changes in fashion, at least for me. And I find that difficult and therefore steer clear. As I say, the only other areas which we avoid, don't avoid, but don't tend to invest too much in is some specialized scientific expertise-based areas of healthcare, where again, the hurdle to learn enough to be differentiated is multiple years and not really worth our investment.
But would I be right in saying that your sort of your proclivity and your focus would mean that banks were unlikely to feature in the portfolio meaningfully.
There's a very high entry barrier to industries that are in oversupply, where we can't immediately see the incentives being aligned between all stakeholders to generate that sort of consolidation and improvement in the economics for all the players.
Got it. E, S, and G. And I said those letters deliberately apart because I think the investment community always wants to push them together and almost equal weight them. I know your fund has been given the top decile MSCI ranking and at the same time appears to have very few, if not zero, holdings that overlap with a list of the most owned positions by the big ESG funds. Just tell me a little bit about how you're approaching this minefield.
Yeah, it's a fair question. Look, I think that the really important point with respect to the E is to recognize that the complexity of the solution is much greater than the seriousness at which we have started it. I feel like the right way to think about this solution is to think about the areas that are affordable and can be implemented relatively easily. So for me, electrification, as I said, was a great place to start. But I think then the next question is, once you understand that there's a demand shock, you really have to work out if there's a barrier to entry. So I'm sure some of your listeners will recall in the early 2000s, the German government made a massive incentive system to try and encourage domestic solar industry to be developed. And all that in reality happened was that the low-cost Chinese labor arbitrage meant that the Chinese flooded the industry with capacity. The German solar shares went bust. The consumer won, but not the shareholder. And I think we've got to be very cognizant that the barriers to entry are reasonably high to be invested in these areas, because otherwise one can easily be sold into the hype. And I think there's serious discussion has to happen about what are the best ways to reduce net zero. I mentioned nature-based solutions. You know, one of the things I really think is possible is that we are going to rethink how we farm. It represents traditional farming, about 15% of the land usage of the world today. And it's relatively unproductive. Through technology, we may be able to generate protein bottom up rather than break it down, bottom up inside manufacturing facilities in a way that could actually mean that we free up a lot of land resource, which in turn can be used to reforest, which in turn can actually abate a huge amount of the human impact on the earth from carbon emissions. And we're only at the beginning of understanding those sorts of things. And my suspicion is that the more unaffordable the high end of the cost curve type solutions are becoming, and I think we're beginning to see that they're unaffordable, we're going to turn to the pragmatic outcomes. And so we're really very early in this, and not being too confident too early in what that final mix of solutions is going to prove, I think, to be the wiser course of action rather than sort of rushing into the ultra green stocks and anticipating that, you know, this sort of 2050 total addressable market that people are sort of pricing in is going to be fulfilled. I think a thoughtful approach to the non-linearities of the regulation on environment is critical. And that underpins a lot of our work. And thinking about where the barriers to entry are very high and where the expensiveness of the solution is not very dear.
Let me ask you about the G in ESG. How do you think about governance?
So the first point is we think active engagement is, as I said, an absolute prerequisite for human-based investing in the future. It's one of the differentiating factors that can skew probabilities in favor of all stakeholders. I think that governance piece is something that we've pursued now for over two decades. So as I say, we've communicated through our own presentation process with over 300 corporates in Europe at least once. So that stakeholder network is something that we think is a moat and also something that has a deep value to us intrinsically, in terms of how we source alpha and new ideas. In terms of governance more broadly, in reality, I would argue that there's been a huge governance deficit around the world. If I may, I've made loads of mistakes. I'm not saying I'm not mistake-free, but
we're going to talk about those in a minute.
but please do. I would say that, you know, capitalists have been a little bit short-termist. politicians have been expedient, regulators likewise. And I think, you know, if I may, I'd say labor unions as well. We've acted as agents rather than principals for a long time across a large swathe of stakeholders. And as a consequence of which, we have a major problem, which is that the world is heavily indebted and needs to invest a lot to resolve a terminal value risk related to the climate. So what do you do? You know, and the issue there is there's a huge governance deficit. And I think what's happening now is that policymakers, to sort of try and solve that crisis, are probably going to fund a huge amount of investment. And as I say, it's almost a vicious circle, because now you get lower rates of growth as a consequence of even more debt, which forces the policymakers into even more of a corner, and they're going to do even more fiscal stimulus, and that's more debt. And it's a bit of a vicious circle. And I think the answer to that is to find companies with sustainable terms of trade that aren't dependent upon excess stimulus or excess debt or some other sort of inequity with stakeholders like the environment. And in the long run, I think if they're attractively priced, that is a very sensible place to be putting capital, despite the various volatilities and fluctuations in the factors from month to month.
So for those who like to badge fund managers into growth or value, am I right in saying that you're pretty agnostic?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Going back to our capital cycle, the first stage of that capital cycle is infancy, which was about the misunderstanding there is the longevity or magnitude of growth. That's a growth opportunity. The second opportunity I described was that transition from adolescence to maturity. That's the structural supply side consolidation of an industry. If you think about what that is, you know, that's value. So depending on where the economy is and where an industry is within its capital cycle, there'll be a preponderance of one versus the other opportunity available at any one time, and we'll shift as we see it. But over time, that creates more or less a balanced mix between the two. And, you know, it's very interesting, because there's been periods where interest rates were very high. 90% of an industry's operators were loss-making. Leverage ratios were very constraining. There was even the risk of bankruptcies and insolvency. That's when you want to look for those transitions between adolescence and maturity, when there's so-called blood on the street and there's a lot of pain within an industry and incentive to combine. You know, in the environment where interest rates are very low, industries often zombify rather than rationalize. You know, and in that environment, it's much more finding the companies which are offering you a structural growth opportunity that isn't yet discounted. So it very much depends where you are. And, you know, for each type of opportunity, a different investment approach is required. We think about that almost as an investor checklist, where, you know, we have a set of types of things we want to identify related to the specifics of the terms of trade of that business when you're looking at a growth opportunity as to when you're looking at a supply side opportunity.
Mistakes. What have you learned and how have you applied them?
I've got to say, I've made many mistakes, as you would imagine, having invested as a fund manager for the last 10 years. The earliest and I think most painful, but hopefully also most valuable, was a recognition within that framework that we described of the importance of the alignment of incentives between all stakeholders with shareholders. So by that, what I mean is, example, telecoms industry, Vodafone, France Telecom, Deutsche Telecom, all of those. In the US, there's only three players. In China, there's three players. In India, there's three players. And how many in Europe? 150. How can Europe create a high-speed, advanced, next-generation broadband digital infrastructure that's upstream of their entire economy without allowing the companies enough scale to afford to invest? And the answer is, it can't be done. The question is there the alignment of incentives between all stakeholders to let that happen? Clearly, as providers of capital, we want it to. The issue has been that it's a great source of tax revenues when you have multiple players bidding for auction spectrum. And in fact, when you merge two companies, the first thing that happens is there are some job losses. Now, in the end, that should be beneficial to the economy, because you create a healthier, larger company that can afford, therefore, to invest. And if your competitors in the long run are Amazon and Google and the big OTT players from the US, you better have scale. So I would say that the sort of morally appropriate thing to do is to allow that short-term pain for the whole to be sustainable in the longer run. But there isn't the alignment of incentives. Politicians and policymakers and regulators and labor unions won't easily allow that consolidation to take place.
And the mistake that you made in that?
We didn't understand that the incentives weren't in place. And what you have to understand, therefore, is not only, of course, that the management want change and you as a shareholder want change, but that it is possible, even with everyone I just mentioned wanting it, that it can happen. And I think that has taken us down the path of applying a very high hurdle to investing in opportunities that require some form of supply-side rationalization in an environment where interest rates are very low.
You also have some investors who want and do actually co-invest in some of your ideas. And just explain to me how that works.
So over time, we have found that our slugging ratios and batting averages have been much higher for our biggest positions. So to be speaking simply, our biggest positions have generated our best relative returns. So where we feel a lot of conviction is typically actually where we've got things most right. And a client of ours has some alignment with that view and has asked us to invest when we see a disproportionate payoff in a single position that is already fully invested in, given liquidity constraints, in the main fund. On three separate occasions, we have put very substantial amounts of capital into individual single stock names. And we feel that's been very beneficial for all of our clients, including in the main fund, because it's creating what I think of as a sort of triangle of alpha, which is sort of marrying the relationships that we've built up with the company managements over two decades, with the analytics that have gone alongside the presentations we've been doing for that many years, and now also the capital that makes you as a reasonable shareholder on their shareholder registry. Here we're talking about, you know, sort of 3% position, but that just makes it more real for the companies that we're investing in, creating that virtuous circle where we get more understanding of their business and engagement over time. And we like the opportunity set that gives us because those co-invests allow us to invest anti-cyclically. So we've been very patient in the last 18 months to do nothing. But now we're starting to feel like the opportunity in this current drawdown is becoming very exciting. And that, we think, is also helpful for all of our shareholders.
I know you assiduously avoid talking about macro and your emphasis is very much more micro, but given the huge and sustained underperformance of Europe versus the US, what would surprise us? Could we be surprised over the coming 5+ years?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I've certainly been very surprised over the last 5 and the 5 before that. So it wouldn't be remarkable that it is hard to predict exactly what is going to happen. I think with my sort of fairly fuzzy crystal ball, what I would say is just that with every crisis, we get opportunity. And Europe was a peace project potentially ahead of its time when, you know, the EU started. It was probably the most ambitious project of my lifetime. Now, what is interesting in the last 2 crises has been the response ultimately has been towards greater rather than less integration when there was clearly the opportunity for the other way around. My sense would be that in response to the evident, the increasingly visible evident lack of self-sufficiency in the inputs that the economy requires to not rely on external but unstable partners, we are going to see joint bond issuance and collectivization of energy policy. I think we're going to see, in other words, massive capex spending. And, you know, for a region that's deficient in demand, that could be quite interesting. I see a lot of likely investment now coming in self-sufficiency or self-security in energy, defense, in green metals, in healthcare, pharmaceuticals. This is going to be a very, very big project. There's huge opportunities that didn't exist before that are really coming into view now. And I think it's only beginning. I also think that it makes it quite clear that you have to be careful not only of trying to own unregulated picks and shovels providers to the modern economy, but don't own the regulated providers to the old economy, because I think that governments are going to need tax revenue. And you can be caught in the crosshairs there in a way that hasn't well been discounted. So again, lots of bifurcation coming, which speaks to active alpha generation as possibly more valuable this next decade than last.
Very clear. So before I sum up, I have to ask you this question, Daniel. I gather you are an avid long-distance runner. Why do you love it?
Oh, great question. Well, I don't know. It's a chance to clear one's head, isn't it, and think about things in a quiet place on your own. You know, that would be the sort of philosophical answer. The pragmatic one may be that I've just become addicted to it because of the morphines. I don't know. But either way, it's been part of my life for 25 years and it works for me.
Great. Well, I like to run. Before sciatica struck me and has inhibited me, I would have been, you know, probably a long way behind you, but also a great fan of that. So, Daniel, I really found this conversation, you know, very illuminating. You know, there are lots of European managers out there. Europe has not been the obvious place to go to for global allocators. You're making a case that certainly within a number of sectors and themes, there's some really interesting change afoot that maybe the market hasn't chosen to really focus on, but might really need to in the coming years. And I understand this is a deeply thought out, analytical, valuation supported approach with what appears to be a correlation to others operating in that space. And your long-term numbers clearly have been very supportive. So, Daniel, I'm going to take away, you know, those points. And I wrote one thing down, which is that your particular ethos within your team is to seek performance over the longer term. And I wrote that down because I think some people talk about that, but we know our industry has been maybe less successful in effecting it. So, Daniel, it's been great having this conversation today. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.